I would describe myself as a philosophical, spiritually in tune black man. In my community, greatness wasn't discussed. Being a lawyer for me was an idea that I can stand on business, or I can stand on my platform to protect people that basically didn't really have a voice. So in terms of my mother and what she did, making sure that my standards were always high, and I always expected my standard to increase. But I'd also say she made sure that I'm consistent in who I am. Everybody's got their own narrative in their life. But depending on whether you actualize those thoughts will then depend on whether it's real or not. Some of my imposter syndrome wasn't necessarily a narrative for myself. It was seeing the narratives around me. I live in a high rise like that. Will I burn to death for that? You got stabbed. Will I get stabbed? You have to always find new ways to reinvent your perception of your environment. Man, if I've gone through all this, I'm still standing. Then there must be a reason. We started almost 3 years ago, and I kid you not, to see people grow into what they're doing, but you know everybody's growing in different ways.
How do you define leadership?
And welcome to Everyday Leadership, a podcast where you get to listen and learn how to lead yourself personally and professionally through the lessons and life experiences my guests share, in the hope that it challenges and inspires you to lead yourself from the inside out and not the outside in.
Welcome to another episode of Everyday Leadership. Today I have someone who, I don't know what the best way to describe my guest. He is a man who does many things, and is a lawyer, public speaker, entrepreneur, poet, consultant. You know, there's a lot of hats that he wears. But for me, I say he's someone who is living his legacy, even from a very young age. It's something that he's been focused on building, and the impact of him going after his legacy is impacting the lives of so many people. And he's someone who I just wanted to spend some time delving into that and just unpacking his story. Akil Hunt, thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you, brother. No, I really appreciate it, man. And yeah, I know all the work you've been doing over the years has been such a blessing, has been touching, you know, thousands of people, you know, through your platform, both through how you work with people on a personal and a international level as well, brother. So yeah, man, I'm excited to see how we can move forward and we can build as well.
So when someone asks you, Akil, who are you? What do you do? How do you break it down to people? Like I say, you do so many different things.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I really think that in order to understand who I am, I have to kind of delve deep into the people who are around me and my village. So I'm a son. So I'm a son to a mother. She raised me in a council estate in West London, more towards Latimer Road. I'm a brother of one brother. He's my older brother, who helped to shape and build my mindset from a very young age. And I would describe myself as a philosophical, spiritually in tune black man who wants to shape futures for next generation through harnessing my authenticity, empowering communities and leading my legacy through those vehicles you discussed, which is law, via social entrepreneurship, via consultancy, public speaking, poetry, to fully project and to emit the vibrations that I hope to deliver for those that are coming up behind me. So yeah, that's how I'd best to describe it, particularly because it's intersectional as well. But you can't even think about your village, and the people that I grew up with and was raised with has really helped to shape that platform.
For us to go back to when you talk about people who have shaped you in that village, what were you like as 8, 9, 10-year-old Akil? What was that young buck like? What were you thinking of at those times?
Wait, that's actually kind of a mad question, because that time was quite traumatic in many different ways. I'm happy to go into it because I've done my therapy and I've done my healing. But around that time, around 8 or 9, I had lost my grandmother. She passed away, and my father was present and absent in my life. So in that period in time, around 8 or 9, as a young buck, growing up in the ends with my mum and my brother, it meant that I wasn't able to fully process or comprehend what the world was in the clearest sense, because a lot of death was around, there's a lot of absences around, and it meant I wasn't really mentally stable. I was quite erratic. My school said I had special needs, and I wasn't seen as drastically intelligent by any teacher. It was kind of a space where I had like a lot of confrontation with people. I wasn't really fitting in. I was pretty much an outlier, and the only people who even believed in me at all was my mum and my brother, my grandfathers and my aunties in some way. So all I really had was my village back then, because outside of that village, even in it with my family, there were still issues and challenges that I had to overcome and grapple with, and overcome some aspects of trauma as well.
Wow, that's a deep thing for a 10-year-old to experience. And I guess as you're navigating that, you now have the external world in schools, for example, telling you that you're not good enough, put on different labels on you. And what you see play out a lot of times, especially for those of us coming from like inner cities, like when you get those labels put on you, you can go one of two ways. You can actually start to live up to those labels, or you can go against the labels. You sounds like very much like you were, I'm going to go against the labels and I'm not going to be stereotyped or stigmatized whatsoever. Because I remember reading some stuff about it, and you were like, from like 15, you were like, I'm going to be a lawyer. So what was it that helped you begin to like reshape and reframe what your life was going to be like, instead of listening to what other people told you?
Yeah, do you know what? I think between the ages of around like 8, 9, 10 and 15, the process of reshaping that narrative was mainly based upon a few things. I think one was that in my community, greatness wasn't discussed and legacy wasn't discussed. And those are two pillars that I really seek to project and emit through my platforms. So when I was younger, I would naturally want to help people, and I naturally wanted to protect them against the world when I didn't feel like it was just. So for me, being a lawyer, for me, was an idea that I can stand on business, or I can stand on my platform at the time to protect people that basically didn't really have a voice or didn't really have anything to speak up for themselves. And I'd say piano was also something that made me not want to become a lawyer per se, in answer to your question, but it made me have the discipline and the time to expand upon increasing the way that I communicate, because I see piano as a form of communication. So I'm a grade 5 pianist. I play piano from 7 up until 15, classically trained. But within that, it meant I had to learn discipline. I had to learn hunger to get through those areas that I mentally had as blockages. So the piano really helped me to unlock mental blockages that I had. And additionally, I'd say to be intellectual, my name Akil means intelligent in Arabic. And for me, as a young person, I wanted to be the most intelligent I could be. And for me, being a lawyer was the hardest thing you could possibly be from where I'm from. So I thought, well, why don't I try to be a lawyer, or in that respect, be one that advocates, because I don't see it. It doesn't exist. So why don't I do something that doesn't exist? Because then obviously it can't be done. And everyone says I can't do it anyway. So I might as well try it. And it was just like trying to defy convention in that respect.
Man's like, you know what? You lot says impossible. Let me go for the impossible. Let's see what happens.
Real life. Because if people are doubting you, and they're trying to doubt you, then you're just naturally going to go against that if you want to win. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. So was you learning grade 5 and being classically trained, did that go alongside the poetry, or did that come later for you then?
Later. So there were two separate things, so I can explain it. So when I was younger, my mum, she wanted me and my brother to learn a discipline or a creative outlet. So she wanted us to engage in piano and do football, all of that. But piano was the thing that was one that we had to develop a continuous mastery in. Before poetry, because I started poetry through rap. So when I was young, I used to rap a lot. It was just a thing that I liked to do, where I was from, in school, wherever, like, if someone puts a beat on the table, best believe I'm going to try ride it. You know what I'm saying? So for me, it was just, it was just the way forward, innit? But with the piano, it was more like, I love the idea of expressing myself creatively over time after the hardness of learning scales and arpeggios and chords. It's very technical world and I didn't understand it. But I started with that and then I moved into the rap side of things, and the poetry came like probably when I was in like my early mid-20s, a few years ago. So it took a bit of time to get there, but I started off with rap after piano. So it was quite a layered process.
Liz, I'm not sure you ever made the connection, but as I listened to you talk about your journey, there's something very powerful about you being able to express outwards and not inwards. I think a lot of times, actually, especially as men, when we go through things, we just keep it and bottle it inside. But for you, it's like, no, whether it's dealing with the death of your grandma or the different things happening in your environment, you're like, no, I need to find ways where I can pour out and not just keep it in. And it seems like there's a cycle, repeat a cycle in there that's been very, very important to you, which has obviously helped you to become the person that you've become as well.
Yeah, for sure. I definitely would say that. And I think pouring outwards for me was really helpful because when I was in school, I felt like academically I wasn't that bright. Creatively, I like it. I'm decent at it. I used to play piano for school assemblies in secondary school and stuff. And I didn't even do music GCSE, music in school like that. They just knew I could play piano and they used me to basically market the school. It was quite mad. Yeah. It was quite mad. So my mum was paying for classes for me because she saved up and paid for the classes. And my school was like, you're so good at piano, you're better than a lot of these people that are doing music in the school. So you might as well play for us and let the parents see you. And as a child, you're like, yeah, cool, like, I'll do it. But when you look back, you're like, but my mum is the one who taught me. It wasn't you. You know what I'm saying? So don't get that twisted. But the parents would come and think, I learned that at school, but I actually learned that back in year 3, year 4, year 5, year 6. So, yeah, it's just quite interesting when you look back. You know, it's just like things you do outside transcend inside, and then people respect you for things that you learned on your own and with the support of your village.
What are some of the key lessons that your mum and your village have taught you that have been like transformational for you?
One that I can publicly share, because there's a lot of knowledge that you learn, and I think it's always best to keep it in-house. particularly when you're a bit rambunctious like myself when I was younger, and I wasn't necessarily always following what everyone wanted me to do. Like, I got in trouble a bit, like, people annoyed me, I wouldn't just take it lightly, that kind of thing. But in terms of my mother and what she did, I say first thing first is don't play games when it comes to your standards. I think making sure that my standards were always high and I always expected my standard to increase is something that she made sure I was as a kid. Like, if I wasn't playing piano properly, she made sure my standards were still high. If I didn't want to do piano, she still made sure I was wanted to try and show I wanted to do. Even if I was saying, Mama, I don't want to do piano, she made me sure that I did. But I'd also say she made sure that I'm consistent in who I am. So if I say I want to be like this, you follow it through. Not, I would like to be like this today and tomorrow, I would like to be like that. She made sure there was a consistency in how I addressed who I wanted to become. So there wasn't like a flip-flap approach, particularly in education. So it meant when I was going through school and to college, I would do the same GCSEs as I would do A-levels to keep the consistency. So, for example, I'm not from a French background, but I can speak some French because I learned French in school, I learned it in college, and she made me have a standard that was quite high to the point where I would have to learn it as the French would in some respects without having anyone around me who spoke French regularly. So, yeah, I think it's just the standards and the consistency, I think, that she taught me more than anything.
Mm-hmm. I can see how that actually plays out and shapes up, because when I look at some of your track record, especially when you went to uni, what, you won, what, 7 awards? You made history as the first student to receive the Dean's Award, like, twice? Like, 2 years in a row?
Yeah, yeah.
You're a trustee of the student union.
Correct, yeah, yeah.
You just went there and just like, I'm just going to mash up the place and just collect accolades for fun. Like, you were not playing, especially when you talk about some of your academic background, when you're like at school, secondary school, you weren't the most academic, but then you went into uni and you just kind of went for it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I can explain why that was the case as well, because essentially I'll be straightforward. Like when I left St. Charles College, St. Charles College was a space where I had a lot of fun and I met people. So for example, Nella Rose, she went to my college, like she was a great vibe, like really engaging personality, like music artists would come to my college, you know, just making up beats and rapping in the halls. Like I remember it like it was yesterday. And a lot of people would be interested in that side. But when I left that space, I knew that I've kind of spent half a year kind of vibes and half a year being serious. So I need to kind of get more serious than have fun. But what that meant was that when I was at university, to be straight, I was just building up my portfolio. It was just everything I see is mine. Like I'm not playing. It's mine. I'm doing it now, today. It's like everything. So any position of responsibility, I'm taking it. Like I never doubted my ability in that first year of university. So that's when I got a scholarship in the legacy of Stephen Lawrence. Like, that's when I got, like, put on the trustee board. That was from the first year. So when I got to my second year, I got loads of imposter syndrome because I thought, I surely couldn't do this like this. Like, I'm exceptionally talented black man. What does that even mean? All black men are exceptionally talented in different ways. Like, how can I be dubbed exceptionally talented and get a scholarship for it? It gives a lot of imposter syndrome. But going through those phases, when I got through that kind of mindset, it was like, well, if I'm here, I might as well eat what's on the table because there's a lot of food. So it was like, let me just keep eating food. And then that's when I started winning more competitions. And then I made a society at university. And then like just bringing people together because I thought, well, I'm here. So I might as well show I'm here and be present. And I didn't expect to win awards for that. It was just more, I want to engage and I want to prosper and I want to still succeed. And I was 2% off getting a first. Because if I did get a first, it would have meant every single aspect of university, I would have got the highest standard. But it also meant it gave me something else to move forward to after university.
You touched on you having imposter syndrome and then you pushing through. Is that something that still affects you now? In fact, let me reframe that question. Do you actually believe that imposter syndrome is real, or is it just what you tell yourself and the story that you tell yourself?
That's an interesting question. And you know what? I think a part of it is the story and a part of it is your thoughts becoming reality from verbalizing your negativity. So from my point of view, I think everybody's got their own narrative in their life. So everybody's come to a point in their life through wherever they've gone. But what I noticed when I was in university was you do create a narrative for yourself, but depending on whether you actualize those thoughts or you verbalize those thoughts will then depend on whether it's real or not. So when I went through second university, I didn't want to go into it because it wasn't necessarily related to as much as my growth. It was more personal transformation. It was going through seeing a young black boy get stabbed to death who I grew up with, and then Grenfell, which happened like 5 minutes from where I live. Going through those things when I was in university made me question my safety. So some of my imposter syndrome wasn't necessarily a narrative for myself. It was seeing the narratives around me and then sometimes reflecting that in my inner psyche where I think, well, I live in a high rise like that. Will I burn to death for that? You got stabbed. Will I get stabbed? It's kind of like your doubts become a reflection of what you see and what you internalize. And then that becomes a narrative. And then if you verbalize that, say, I don't want this to happen. And then it's fear. And then your fear becomes your doubts. And then your doubts. So for me, I feel like if you verbalize the imposter syndrome and you verbalize the internal psyche that you create for yourself, it then becomes your reality because you're making everyone believe that you don't have this, you don't have that. And then it affects your confidence and your ability. And that happened to me. So I think when you verbalize it less and then you put more action in, you dispel that narrative. So I think action is always the pivotal point in making sure imposter syndrome doesn't become your reality. Because if you don't put any actions in place, it then becomes a narrative that you play to too often. And yeah, it then prevents you from moving forward.
In that period of time, did you speak up to your friends and share what you were going through? Like, what was it that allowed you to voice it out, like you said, and get it out there that helped you navigate that space and think the way that you're thinking? Because the way you just described it, I think for me, is a very powerful way of processing it, because so many people can cling on, I got imposter syndrome, I can't do this. But the way you just broke it down for me works. So I'm curious, like, did you holler at were you have friends around you where you had real talk conversations like, this is what I'm navigating right now, and they kind of helped you get through that? Yeah. Like, what was it for you?
Yeah, I'd go back to the basis, my brother and my mum. So my brother and my mum, they were pillars at this time, because I remember very distinctly, after Grenfell happened, it was a summer after the young boy got stabbed to death. And I remember, like, my brain felt like it was on fire. And I was, like, literally, like, rolling in my bed, like in agony, because I felt in so much pain. And no one was there. Like, no one saw it, innit? But I know that my mum and my brother, they always wanted to check in, because they knew I wasn't as communicative as I could be. And I remember when I was with my brother at the time, he would always say, yo, put in the work, put in the actions. He just keep telling me, just keep moving, no matter what. So it was never the case where I could really sit on my pain or sit on my trauma, because it was not keep moving. Even mum was saying that, yo, it's good. Keep getting active, keep getting out there. Like, you know, I know that you didn't get this job. Like, one summer I had like 2 interviews to get a job as a lawyer. I didn't get any of them. And my mum was like, no, you just got to keep going. And I feel like the conversation I had with them when I was going through it was very minimal. But because they told me to maximize my actions, I would kept speaking to them about it. And they're like, it's cool, but you can just keep going. So when I spoke to them about it, it was like, I appreciate you're going through a lot, but I know you can do this though. And it's that belief in me that just kept the drive and the hunger, because I wanted to give up so many times. And then my friends would be there, but they wouldn't really understand. So I couldn't really tell my friends all about Grenfell, because they're the ones watching it on the news where I'm there on the estate, seeing the ambulance, the fire brigade taking out the fire and all of that. Like, they don't really know what that means for me. They just know what it means for them. So they wouldn't really relate to it. Whereas my mum and my brother, they live in the area, they know it. Like, they knew the young boy who passed away as well. So if I felt the need to talk about it, they would be able to speak life into me to just keep going. So I don't just look back at the trauma.
How much, you just talked about all of that, the death of like Fola, and how much that affected you. But you sound like you managed to turn that trauma and that pain into something that sparked something inside of you to want to really make a difference in the community, in the lives of other people. Because like I said, a lot of people might not be able to relate. They can see it. They can, like, oh my gosh, that's sad. Another young black boy has lost his life. But for you, because we're so close to you, close to home, close to where you grew up, that was your end. There was something that sparked something, a different processing for you of how can we utilize this and how can we avoid this happening going forward?
100%. Yeah. I think just on that point about using that pain and trying to turn it into something that you support and your belief system, I think that's helped me on my journey to being a lawyer to this day and in the intersection of the other areas, because I think when I went through more trauma a couple of years ago, I remember that there was a lot of triggers. And I remember that poetry really helped to get away from those triggers, because the creativity of voicing it led to me being able to have better conversations with people, because I've articulated it in a way that I understand. And I think when you go through a lot of pain or trauma, and it becomes it, especially when it comes to people like Fola Rabaye, who was so young, like he was like 17, you know what I'm saying? Like, and when someone's taken, you're like, you know that tomorrow is not guaranteed. You know that there's families that are grieving hard. Like, I remember going to the house afterwards and seeing his mum and us, and I couldn't even understand what she was going through. And to this day, I know it still affects her. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's one of those things you never forget. And I think when you have irreplaceable memories as such, you can't really just avoid them and then lock them and then just do something completely different, like just be a lawyer and help all these corporates like move forward. Because I felt like I can do that, but who am I benefiting at the end of the day? And I feel like going through everything just helps me understand, like, I know who I can benefit from my experiences, because they're real experiences and they're things that I just feel like hopefully provide touch points for people that have gone through similar things and are scared to talk about them.
Okay. It's interesting when I listen to you talk, there's a phrase that keeps on coming back into my head, which is a phrase that I want to dispel a lot, and you're kind of speaking into that, so I'm going to call it out. We have this phrase a lot of times where we talk about being a strong black man, and people have their definition of what it means to be a strong black man. A lot of times it's stoic and you just keep it all in. And yeah, like I said, your boy growing up in the South, and you're actually dispelling that myth in a way that shows that no, like, being a strong black man doesn't mean that I don't talk, it doesn't mean that I don't share, it doesn't mean that I don't have a village of people around me. It means that I am human, I go through stuff, but actually what makes me strong is being able to utilize my pain and my experiences to make a difference to other people, not just bottling things up or not just showing up in a physical way. And I think it's a message that needs to be heard more and more and more and more, because so many times people think about ways of what can I do to make a difference? I'm like, there's so much stuff you can do to make a difference, but you need to be able to slow down and have that internal conversation. And that's something that sounds like you've done over and over and over again. And it's not one time done, because life is always going to keep on happening to you. You're going to always have experiences. You're always going to have trauma. But once you have mechanisms, once you have ways of recognizing your triggers, you don't go as far back as you would have done before, and you get up a lot quickly and you can go again. I think that's such a powerful testimony that you're actually breaking down right now.
Thank you. And actually, I think it's so opportune having this conversation right now, because I think over the past, I'd say, it's not just the past few months, but the past few years, I felt so many times I just wanted to give up, because there's been so many times where, like, I've had a lot of trauma, and that it gets to the point sometimes where I can't think straight. So, for example, trauma isn't for me as I am just seeing Grenfell Tower burn or knowing a young boy has been stabbed to death. Like, for me, the trauma is also based on bonds I've had with people who, you know, sometimes betray you, or it comes back off, like, you're trying to grow as a lawyer and then people doubt your ability and try to, you know, dismiss your credentials. I think when you go through those different elements of life, you start to kind of create a perspective that, you know, I might as well just stop. And I think sometimes you can die in your spirit without it just being solely due to what everyone else can see. And I feel like my spirit has kind of like been taken from me a few times, and it's kind of been like sucked out of me just due to everything. But I really started to notice recently that every time I go through a cycle of a season where I feel like, even recently, things have been taken away from me and I don't feel as powerful as I usually do, it usually gives me more strength to move forward again. And then when I get that strength, it leads to that next stage of that growth. And that's one of the beauty things that I've looked at over time. It's that every time I feel like it's just not worth the time, not worth the energy, like, even doing the podcast today and then doing other things today, I said, but can I do it? Like, of course. Like, and every single day I have to, like, tell myself, bro, you got this. Like, you can do this. Because the brain just tricks you so much when you get into spaces of uncomfortability and of growth, because it's not used to you having to manage these different responsibilities of, you know, having to care for a woman that you love, or, you know, make sure your mother's good, or, you know, make sure that your, you know, your team is good, like, you know, make sure you're excelling in your career. Like, these are different things, and I've been feeling it of late, and I feel like when it gets uncomfortable, it makes me anxiously optimistic because I don't know what to expect from this, but I know that it's meant to be happening. Because if it's not happening, then I might as well just stay stagnant and just do what everyone else expects me to do, which will be different to what I would expect myself when I'm in my peak form.
Jeez. Akil came to preach today.
I was being real, man. Yeah.
If you haven't already, can you please follow the podcast? It really helps us grow and it tells the apps that it's a podcast worth listening to. Which the fact that you're listening to means that it is and other people need to know about it. In Apple Podcasts, if you click the three dots in the top right of your app, look for the follow button and click on it. And in Spotify, the follow button should be just below the show's artwork. Now let's get back into today's episode.
You know what, though? And I love it. And I think it's a powerful statement. And it's a powerful way of actually thinking and recognizing that there are times when even as you're sent to new heights and you get there and it will feel every single time it feels foreign to you. Every single time. Absolutely. And people will say to me like, when you step in something new, like, doesn't it feel great? I'm like, it feels great. But it's scary because like you said, you don't know what it is. You've never been there before. So there's gonna be so many different things in your brain telling you you shouldn't, especially some of the spaces that are white spaces, predominantly white spaces, there are going to be so many things telling you you should not be there. And you have to keep reminding yourself that, no, like, I should be here. I got this one step at a time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That makes so much sense, my brother. And as somebody who has gone through the legal space and has noticed that, you know, there's hardly brothers like me. I'm going to be real. There's not brothers from low-income households, from the black community, who had to excel in various facets to enter into the industry. Like, there's not... So when you step into those spaces, you have to always find new ways to reinvent your perception of your environment. And I found that, quite frankly, when I start to embrace a bit more of me, I bring more people out of their shows. Because people will be in their shows if they just think I'm not like them. So by hiding who I am, and be a bit more timid or more subservient to status quo in a particularly white, middle-class environment, it means I don't really relate. But if I say, oh man, I'll have a rice and peas with some curry goat the other day, it was wicked, you know, you should come to this spot in Brixton. If I say that, then they know I'm just being myself. I'm not really fudging it. But if I said, oh yes, I love quinoa and rye breads, like, and then they ask you about it, like, oh yeah, I ate it like 5 years ago, like why would they, you know? But that's what I've learned, to have like just better conversations, particularly in these environments, because you know, you can try and find ways to bond on things that I'm learning and say, oh, I didn't really know about that, especially when it's something out of my comfort zone and I try to ask. But then when it's something that I know, I'll just be straight and say, this is what I know, you know what I'm saying? I don't know anything about that. But that willingness to learn and engage and reinvent your perception of your environment helps so much, because it means from my perspective, it's easy for me not to get stuck in my head about what exists and what doesn't exist and how to build relationships, particularly when it can be perceived that you're not like the other people who you're speaking to.
So how was it when you landed in the first law firm that you actually worked with after uni, one of the largest law firms in the world? Yep. Amazing environment, but yes, challenging environment. Like you said, there would not have been any, if not, like, you might have been the only one there, or there would have been just a handful of you. How was it like for you navigating that space? And when did you go from recognizing that I needed to be my authentic self as opposed to pretending to be someone else?
Yeah, that's interesting, you know. So how do you go from navigating being your authentic self to pretend to be someone else? I would actually say when I started, a very traumatic thing happened. Like, again, prior. Like, unfortunately, in this conversation, there's a lot of traumatic points where there's big things happening in my life. So it's easy for me to remember them because I know exactly how I was feeling at the time. So when I started my training contract, someone that I love dearly passed away from cervical cancer. And I remember, like, I was, like, in absolute ruins at the time because the pain was a different type of pain. It was never a pain I'd experienced before. And I remember when I went into the law firm, it was literally, like, that happened, like, 3 days before my birthday. And then, like, 10 days after my birthday, I was meant to start. So for me, it was kind of like I wasn't really emotionally ready to start training because I wasn't really thinking about that. I was trying to go over how my own emotions. So when I started, I kind of blocked everything out and I blocked a lot of people out of my life because I didn't really want them to know me. So it was easy to hide in the space in the law firm because I could go and have drinks with my colleagues. I could go and vibes with them. You know what I'm saying? I would like have like all the fun in the world trying to convince myself that I'm good, I'm fine, and we can get along. But what I learned in that journey, and the transition probably happened, I would say, early, mid-2022, when I went on the Future Boss program. And I would say that, like, I started to notice when I went to Kenya in the year before, in December, I started to notice that I'm not really being myself at the moment. I'm being like a shadow version of myself because I noticed that I wasn't engaging in who I genuinely was. I was trying to be the person that was palatable. And I think that happens to a lot of people from our community when they go to corporate spaces. They try to be a person that is palatable for the corporate environment. But then I noticed, like, mid-2023, that's long, bruv. Like, why am I trying to be palatable? This doesn't make any difference to me whether or not anyone likes me or not, because I'm not here to be liked. I'm here to thrive. I'm here to build who I am, innit? So when that happened, I noticed a shift in my energy and I started to just do things that I wanted to do a lot more. So whether we go to Uganda for the Future Boss program or, you know, going to my community and prioritising engagement with people that I could connect with, once I made it a priority, I noticed that I wasn't going to be a corporate guy. And then that's when I think the journey changed for me because it meant I was no longer trying to be palatable to please people who didn't understand who I was. I was just going to be myself. You like me or not, I'm going to be like this. So if you want this, take it. If you don't, I'm going to do it and I'll do it sick and you're going to regret it. So, yeah, that change probably happened, I'd say, 6 to 8 months into my training contract. So it took a bit of time. But yeah, for the first 6 to 8 months, I wasn't really emotionally available and I wasn't really paying attention to what I was genuinely going through.
Well, one, shout out to Viv and the Future Boss and that amazing incubator program that's spitting out incredible humans. It is churning out some amazing
it's a blessing.
People of the future for sure. Yeah, like Viv's done an amazing job with that. But it's interesting hearing you say that when you did not tap into your emotions and when you hid them, you were a shell of who you are. But when you, in a sense, exposed the wounds that were there and you took time to delve into them, you allowed you to step into the fullness of who you were and who you're becoming. And I think a lot of times people think that when I hide my emotions, when I put a band-aid over the wound, a little plaster over the wound, it feels good and I'm okay. But actually, you're just pointing to the fact that actually you're not okay. You're a shell of who you are. The fullness of who you can be means you have to sometimes sit in that mess. And I said to clients all the time, you have to sit in the mess sometimes, explore that wound, get it healed up properly. And that healing process is not overnight, but that healing process is a journey. But when you're doing that, it allows you to get that, in a sense, a superpower. And those experiences build you into something else, allows you to go to that next level. And when you're like, I got to that point, like, I'm just going to do me. Whether you like it, great. If you don't, you don't. But that's on you. That's a you problem. That's not me problem. Mm-hmm. So why am I hiding for? And it's such a powerful statement. Mm-hmm. It's that powerful place. Powerful but painful place to be sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. It can be a very powerful place. And I think that's what really unlocked, like, the poetry, unlocked the podcast show. It unlocked, like, all these other elements to me because I felt like once I started to do the therapy again and I started to really tap into my wounds, I started to notice, like, bruv, if I've gone through all this, I'm still standing. Then there must be a reason. So I might as well just push on because, you know, what's the point of going through all of this if I'm not kind of manifesting my future in the way that I see fit? It doesn't make sense. So for me, I felt going through that spirit period of time and going, you know, through trailblazers like Viv and people, you know, around him as well, who were really critical in building up the community to where it is going, I feel like it just gives you that knowledge that being a lawyer doesn't necessarily mean I'm going to be the lawyers that I see. Being a lawyer is going to be like being the people that I know are doing the work that needs to be done in the way that creates that future for the community that, quite frankly, doesn't necessarily have many people who can call themselves leaders. You know what I'm saying? It's quite upsetting to say. But yeah, I feel like it definitely unleashes a new side of you and it gives you that emphasis to say, you know what? I'm not stopping. I'm going. And it just gives you that new lease of life, yeah.
With you doing that, you stepping into this new lease of life, there are a number of different things that you now started to begin to create and put out into the world, which is focused on other lawyers coming up behind you and building what I'm going to call an ecosystem where people feel supported as they're going into these firms. Like, what was it that inspired you to create that? And also, how much work is it? Because people see stuff, people see programs, people see communities created and they look good. But there's a lot of work that goes behind it. And I want you, as someone who's doing it, to actually speak into that so people recognize that when you're putting stuff out there and they don't turn up, yeah, there's a lot of work that goes behind it, so they need to be supporting.
You know, man. You know what? I'll be real. Like, before I started trying to create ecosystem to get people into law, I tried something similar before. But it wasn't about law. It was about empowering the community. It was because I made a concept in the university called The New Black. I want to bring that concept to the wider world and try to get a team together to move it. But I didn't invest enough in my leadership skills. I didn't invest enough in my emotional intelligence. I didn't invest enough in creating that space during the pandemic to lead. So I took a step back and said, this doesn't make sense. I can't lead. And reevaluated. Then literally, probably less than a year later, that's when I set up the NRG Lawyers as an ecosystem to help non-Russell Group students and graduates get into law. With the amazing team that I've got. But the funny thing is, because we started off my last time as full energy, full engagement, let's just go out there, make impact, it's fine, everyone will support us. That's not how you build an institution. Like, you got to do the opposite way around. Create everything so the energy can subsist in it for the long term. So what you know what I'm saying? Because when you do full energy, it's like energy's there, energy's gone. There's no framework. You know what I'm saying? And then what I noticed is that in this venture, it's still similar where there's challenges. You know what I'm saying? It's still similar where there's challenges. But I feel like we have to create so many things in place to keep the foundation there so we know what we're building off, so we're not building off sand. So that meant the first 6 to 8 months of us being a team meant us not being visible to the public. It meant we're just backroom planning, plotting, 30-page documents, putting in, redrafting it, looking at that, cool, advisory board, patrons, get people on board, cool, branding, marketing. Out of my own pocket, I paid $1,000 just to get things off the ground, like without any corporate support, without any law firm support, university support, etc. Like, it was just back pocket, put in, get the right things. And then literally by the time we launched, really had like an infrastructure in place to move. And then it meant we had to keep meeting and keep building and then basically use our foundation to create energy. And it's so challenging when you're not doing it full time, because it's like, it means you're having to check in with people and different stakeholders, different people. We've got corporate members now who work with us and like set up the meetings and whatnot. You've got to break the time out the day to make sure that they're getting what they need out of the relationship. And then, you know, almost like living multiple lives when people need you. And it's very intense. But it's so rewarding as well, because I feel like when you create the foundation infrastructure and you see people grow in it, like we started almost 3 years ago, and I kid you not, to see people grow into what they're doing. You see, some people soar and some people struggle, but you know everybody's growing in different ways, and it gives you that sense that, like, as much as we're nowhere near where we want to be, that we're still yet to grow over five figures in revenue yet, so that's still something that we're looking to do. Like, we're still looking to, you know, create impact to over 500 NRG students and graduates. We're currently at like 350 approximately. Like, we're still trying to hit milestones, but to see where we started and see where we've gone, it's a blessing. But boy, it takes energy, but without a foundation, there's nothing that can grow from that.
I guess it leads me to ask the question then, when I hear you taking the time to build that, taking money out of your own pocket to create and get this off the ground, learning from your lessons from uni and making sure the infrastructure and foundation is in place, what do the words that you used at the start, legacy and greatness, mean to you then?
Yeah, that's hard to answer in like one like concise way.
Bruv, don't be concise. Legacy. You don't need to be concise.
you know, because sometimes I don't like to waffle. You know, when you've got so many things that trigger, like, and you're like, I can't say all of them, but I'll try and sequence it so I integrate it within, like, what I'm trying to say, innit? But for me, legacy means the ability to serve and create outlets that impact people beyond your contribution. So for me, to summarize what that means as well, so I can like create a good picture, it means like when I'm not building this in the way that I'm able to do it, because I'm able to push forward, what I've done is benefiting people because of the work that's been put in to support them over time. So it doesn't just rely on my sole contribution. It means that the legacy of the project can subsist without my consistent contribution and my consistent input. Because I don't think legacy needs to be about you, it needs to be about what you're providing for people and giving to them so they have resources to move. So I see legacy to transcend my contribution and allow people to contribute within the same space to give more support for those that are coming up. So yeah, that's where I really see legacy at, and a lot of things I'm doing now are done so hopefully I don't have to be known to be part of it, but what I have created and contributed to has legacy with it, because people know when they hear that, that's that, and they're able to benefit from that. And with greatness, for me, there's so many things attached to greatness, but I feel like it's creating a mark in the world that has a level of permanence to it. So for me, I feel like people that are great and live amongst the greats, they create a work that has permanence to it, whereby there's people who will look at the work they've done and see the level it's at and be like, to get to that level, you can't just walk up into it. You have to build up to that level and then make sure the quality is at a point where over time, people can see it and respect it. So that, for me, greatness is creating things that have such a level of quality that people know about it and see it as a marker of quality. So they know that's a threshold to reach up to. And I think there's some intersections between legacy and greatness in terms of how they exist, because to be great, you want to leave a legacy, and sometimes you can't create a legacy without being great at what you're doing. I think they do bounce off each other, but for me, I aspire more for greatness than legacy at this point in time, because I think legacy happens after you've been great over a period of time, and then that cements your legacy. So yeah, they do bounce off each other as perspectives.
I like that. I like the intersection between both of them and the pursuit of greatness, I guess, and I'm going to call it the short term in a sense, when there's a longer term and the short term, creates the legacy in the longer term. And there's a point that you made there where it's around actually,
yeah,
I want to build things where it's not just about me and my name, it's things that can live on and make an impact, which is such a, way of taking your ego out of it, because it's not about you. It's just about what you're creating for other people. And it's a great trait to actually have, to be able to take your ego out of situations. Especially, I think we live in a day and age where it's look at me, look at what I've done, look at my name and blah, 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 blah. And you're like, nah, like, that's not greatness. That's not legacy. This is about others. So how can we build and create stuff where they're not coming for a kill? They're coming for what has been built for them, regardless of what I'm attached to or not, which is a powerful, powerful thing to do.
Yeah, man. And I feel like you have to build your name so people know to trust when you build something, that it can be done in a great way. And that's something that I really hold true. And I feel like with you and this platform, you enable people to know that your platform can support and grow people who are leaning into everyday leadership. So hopefully that means that everyday leadership can become its own platform that in one day can have people who run it and support it and build it from your legacy, because you're great at what you do. And I think one thing that I've learned in my space is that I have to create strength in knowledge of my identity, but I can't allow that to be all people want to hear about. So, for example, at NRG Lawyers, once we had a meeting, this was like a couple of years ago, and people came to the call, and I remember the first thing was said, I know Akil from da-da-da-da. And I said, can we just stop that, please? We don't need to say where you know me from. Like, this isn't a Stormzy song. You know what I'm saying? Because we're not coming here to, like, we're not coming here to talk about, like, me. We're coming here to talk about the purpose. And I think that's why we've been able to move for a couple of years, because we know that it's not about individuals. It's about how do we contribute to the overall mission. And I think if you can build a brand that allows that mission to be pushed forward, that's a benefit, but it shouldn't be the sole determining factor in where you go.
So for those of you who are listening, NRG Lawyers, not-for-profit organization, paving the way for non-Russell Group students and graduates that kind of help guide and support them through their legal career. Check it out. Support it. Corporations, lawyers, students, it caters for so many different things. And this is what they're building, and this is the reason why. And it's such a great cause. And apart from NRG, you also got your podcast that you're doing as well.
Yeah, still got a podcast, so it's still early stages, so I'm still learning. And I've had to, like, reevaluate how I approach it, because I feel like there's so much I want to do with that space, because I don't want it just to be a podcast show. I want it to be, like, its own thing, whereby, like, it can live on its own legs. And, it, you know, when you're leading your legacy, you've got the Americans on it, the Canadians on it, you know, you've got the Australians on it, you know, you've got the, you know, South Africans, where they're all talking about leading their legacies within their separate spaces. You know, I'd love that to be the space for it. But I'm still thinking about strategically, how do I build that going into the end of season one and going to season two and creating experiences for people. We did a launch event last year. It was sick. Like, the energy and the vibes was sensational. And I really want to recreate that in various ways. But for me to do that, I know how much energy I need to invest in that. So I'm just trying to think, how do I do it in a very clear and precise way so it grows? So Leading Your Legacy is a podcast show that aims to unmask hidden stories and amplify authenticity through spotlighting people who are leading legacy in various forms. So, you know, it's still a platform that I really feel like is important, because I want people to, particularly those that are shaping their legacies at the beginning stage where they're going, to really show people what it means to lead a legacy as a Gen Z, as a millennial. And then over time, I want to have an intergenerational aspect where the people that have already built their legacies and are still building it can speak to those that are at the start. So we can speak, what are we building together and how are we building it? So over time, people are building something that lasts a test of time. So there's so much I want to do with it, man. There's so much. But I know that for me to do it, I have to really buckle up on the business of it, but also I have to buckle up on the intention and the purpose on how I push it out, which I don't think I've done well enough over the past few months. So, yeah, it's definitely something that will grow and will be a big part of my life, but I'm waiting for the long-term plan to play out with it, because you can't build Rome in a day.
You can't, but you start one brick at a time. And there's always this old, you know, obviously being African, this old school proverb when it comes to you, like how do you eat a cow? And it's like one piece at a time. Like that's the and it's always stayed with me, you know. It's like them bars from the wise old generation that came way before us. But I'm like, it is what it is. You're starting it, you're figuring it out, and yeah. That's the important part of that. And you got the podcast, you got NRG Lawyers, obviously you got your job as well. And I'm curious, actually, with everything else that you're doing, are there other areas that you're thinking, I want to also step into? Or when you think about your legacy, you think about greatness, is there more to what you want to do, what you want to pour out there?
So much more, man. So much more, because I feel I'm only at the beginning stages of what I'm building. So for me, I haven't really shown everything that I want to build as a at this point in time. Because I think if you move too fast, you go alone. But if you want to go further ahead in a longer period of time, you have to build everything in stages. So for me, there's so many things I want to do in terms of the books and releasing those as like discussions on my life. You know, I'd love to long term like work with organizations, particularly those that don't understand the intersections of people in the legal industry and how to grow and support them in where they're going. Like, I'd really love to do that, particularly when organizations have that social focus on social diversity. I think that's just so important to me, and I'd really love to do that. But these are all things that I'd like to do long term, because I feel like if I did it now, I don't have the experience to be able to navigate those conversations and whatnot. But I would love to grow into those areas of things, and I'd love to grow into the poetry more. I've got my first spoken word piece to be released. At a point this comes out, it'll probably be released. But for me, like, I really want to manifest my creativity through so many forms. And there's even things I'd like to do like in the media as well, in the long term, which is just so important to me, to project real stories, whether that be through leading your legacy or working with people that have been doing it for decades. I'd love to share more authentic stories. So there's so much I want to do, but for me, there's only so much time. So, you know, I just hope that over time that these things can be played out. And also internationally, being able to triangulate my perspectives, so I could show from various jurisdictions how similar we are in our values and ethos, particularly when we're leading a life of legacy and authenticity to empower community. Yeah, but so much I want to do. But yeah, man, we'll just have to see how the next few years go.
And that's it. It's knowing you, knowing what you've overcome, what you've been through, but also knowing how you show up when it comes to excellence. I have no doubt that all these different things that you're talking about, you're going to make them happen. And when you talk about the next generation coming up, like, man, you're still young. Like, you got... you're still young.
Yeah.
And like, God, pure time on your hands to do what you want to do. And it all goes back into that point you made earlier on around greatness. You're stepping into the different things. You're not doing it by yourself. You're surrounding yourself with the right people. Other people are going to come into your life and support those different endeavors as well. And as you start to build out those things which are around greatness, it helps to kind of get you into that long-term goal of your legacy. So I'm looking forward to supporting, championing you, sharing your journey, like telling people more and more, like, yo, you heard about Akil and what he's doing, like, make sure you go on and support him, because for me, it's so needed. And that's what's gonna take for us to make it a reality, man. You're changing the game out here, man. So it is so great to see.
Thank you, my brother. I appreciate the flowers, and I know there's so much work to do, man, and I just appreciate the work you have been doing, you know, over the past like 5, 10, 15 years. I'm in the game, like, in terms of building who you are, because I can tell, like, you know, when you spend time to focus on your art and focus on your credibility, it shows. And yeah, man, there's so much blessings that come from people like yourself who really gone on roads that inspire people like myself and others as well, who are really looking to lean into leadership and lean into authenticity, man. So I really appreciate what you're doing as well, man. Hopefully, you know, I know I'm still young, but sometimes when I look back over the time, I was like, my mind has always been on future. Like, even when I was at uni, I would try to go to the college, or, you know, we'll go to the school and just try to build people up, you know. I've done so much volunteering, it's insane. But yeah, man, yeah, I just hope that we can continue to do what we're here to do.
Sure. I guess my last question to you as a wrap up would be, how do you define leadership?
Mm-hmm. So that's interesting. So for me, leadership is taking the initiative to grow and develop yourself with the intention to serve others. So for me, a real person who engages in leadership is somebody who doesn't shy away from what they know to be the truth and provides an outlet and a platform for those who are going into spaces to also to do the things that they know is correct and do the things that they know can allow them to thrive. I think leadership sometimes is conflated with management, and it's also conflated with the idea that to be a leader, you have to be the loudest in the room, and, you know, you have to be the most vocal, or you have to be the most passionate. Whereas I think the leader is probably the most consistent, and they're the person who allows more people to do things, because you can't be a leader without being an enabler. It just doesn't work. Because, you know, it's going to sound funny, but there was a song back in the day, it's called I'm a Boss, and it says, like, a OG is one who stands up on his own feet, a boss is one who guarantees you go and eat. You know, it's basically saying, like, you can be credible and stand up on your own, but you can't say that you're a boss or a leader if you're not allowing other people to benefit off of your platform. Because then you're just somebody who's basically just doing it for themselves. And doing for self, for me, isn't just real leadership. It's doing for the wider spaces that you occupy. So, yeah, I think that's how I would describe leadership.
You know what? That's I'm just gonna leave that there. I'm never gonna add anything else to it. I think that's a perfect way to end this conversation, because every time I ask people that question, I always find it interesting to see, like, has what this person's just shared over the last hour, does it marry up to that? And it is. The way you just kind of broken down leadership is how you've been living your life, is how you've been showing up, is how you've, even the different things you've built and when you're still building, you can see that flow all the way throughout. So thank you. Thank you for today. All the information around Akil, around NRG, around the podcast will all be shared in the show notes. So make sure you check him out. Like I said, make sure you support for sure, because he's doing amazing things out there. He's changing lives, and he's doing it in such a real and authentic way that needs to be heard a lot more. And a lot more voices like him need to be just put out there into the spotlight. So thank you very much, Akil, for coming on today. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Much love, man. The pleasure's all mine.
This is Everyday Leadership. We'll see you next week. While you're still recovering from that amazing conversation, let me give a quick preview of what we got coming up next.
Everything that I do, I always want to give 100%. That's just no matter what I do, which can sometimes be, I think, to my detriment, because I take on lots of things and then you're like giving out so much energy. And, you know, it's why I'm doing my PhD at the moment. And it's really difficult, but I'm halfway through and I won't give up. So I've got to, anything I start, I always feel like I have to finish it. Working in the petrol station was a really great opportunity. I think one of the foundations of my career, because it was a really busy petrol station. I had to, you know, have lots of customer services. You had to make sure that you had to, say, open up on time. You had responsibility from a monetary perspective, making sure that all of the cash added up and everything like that.